Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you the Art Monthly talk show once again. The talk show is based on writing within the magazine of Art Monthly, usually the current issue to the time of recording. So this issue that we are referring to is number 497, June 2026, Art Monthly. And I'm joined today by Mark Prince, who is a writer and critic who's based in Berlin. So he's talking to me from Berlin and I'm in London. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Matt.
Thank you for coming on once more. Now, this is a feature you've written. Basically, generally speaking, for listeners, it's on sculpture. Now, unusually, really, for Art Monthly, the idea of writing about painting or sculpture, it's almost, to me, it's an unusual event, really, because we don't tend to, lots of artists we cover work in many different ways within their own work. They may use video sculpture, they may not even think about sculpture as a term, some of them, and perhaps some of the people you refer to may equally not really call themselves sculptors, but we wanted to try to get you to talk about that. I'm just going to read the intro to the piece, which we wrote. I don't think you wrote it. It says that you argue that sculpture's once default position as a surrogate for presence, as a stand-in for the viewer's own sense of occupying time and space, has been challenged in ways that have taken sculpture in a new and more interesting directions. Now, I wanted to just try to not jump to the more interesting directions, but to try to lay out, as you do, carefully, really, I mean, in a way, what sculpture is and then how it's changed. And you first talk about Anne Truitt and her work in the 70s, I believe. Would you like to try and do that now? Just to sort of, why did you bring her in? Because she's threaded throughout the whole piece, really, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about sculpture. In a way, more in the sense that it can mean almost anything now. I mean, what do we? Maybe in the 19th century, if we spoke about sculpture, we could have had a very clearly defined idea of what we meant. But now, at least since the 1960s, you can mean almost anything by that term. So, I mean, you can mean video, you can mean installation work, you can mean things that are almost disembodied without any physical form. You can mean purely what we call conceptual art. You can mean so many different things, and people can call it sculpture. Which is not the case with painting. So in a way, it's a different medium designation than it's kind of an exceptional medium designation. But in this case, I wanted to write about sculpture following a more traditional definition in terms of something which is three-dimensional objects in space, art or three-dimensional art objects in space, and to think about what that could still offer as a mode for dealing for contemporary artists.
Yeah,
you're right. I go back to the 1960s and 70s. Well, even the 50s.
Truitt was actually 1960s. My mistake, not 70s.
No. I mean the work that you're right. The work that I actually talk about is the work that I write about of hers. She started to make in the late 60s, early 70s, in the 70s. So it's really, you're right, it's the 70s. She's someone who, I think I first became aware of her work when I read a very a famous essay by Michael Fried, who was a critic in the 1960s, written in the 1960s, and he was a critic who was very much pro what you could call formalist, American formalist art. And he was, and it was an essay called Art and Objecthood, which was actually an essay arguing against the new minimal sculpture, which is being started, which is being made in the 1960s. And he was resisting this work, and arguing from a perspective of the of abstract painting, which had been made since the 40s in America. And then there'd been this shift over the past few years, and he was resisting the shift. I think he mentions a work by Anne Truitt in that essay. But he actually raises her work to as an example of formalist art, not the kind of art that he's resisting or actually denigrating. He doesn't like minimal art. He calls it theatrical in a pejorative way.
Are we talking about Donald Judd or?
Yeah, stuff like that. Donald Judd, Robert Morris, that kind of work, which he doesn't like. But he brings up Anne Truitt's sculptures as an example of the work, the kind of work he is interested in.
What's the difference he makes between the minimalism and her work? Is it to do with the fact that they're painted, say, by hand a bit, as well as being quite minimal? Because they're tall. I mean, you've written here four faceted vertical wooden columns painted with panels of flat monochrome colour.
Mm.
But they're actually hand painted, I think, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, they're actually quite difficult to define, which is why I'm interested in them. I think that as is implied by the, in fact, they fall between what you could call a minimalist definition of sculpture and a formalist definition of art, so that they are they're ambiguous in that way, and that's exactly why I thought they were interesting for what I wanted to write about, which is the way that sculpture effaces itself, in the sense that if you think about how does minimal object making work, well, traditionally it was about encouraging a direct physical subjective phenomenological engagement with objects in space. Art objects were in the gallery space presented by the artist, often geometric, so to avoid representational issues confusing the matter. So in a way, these objects have a lot of the qualities that kind of work had, in the sense that they're three-dimensional, they're geometric, you encounter them in space. They also have some kind of implied relation to your own body, which is one of the things that you can say of a Robert Morris sculpture, or a Donald Judd box, they have those qualities, but they also have another quality, another dimension, which contrasts with that, I think, and that is that they have a lot to do with formalist painting, in the sense, as you say, that they are painted. They're painted with these flat monochrome colours. And I think that aspect of them takes them in an opposite direction. So that they're, formalist painting, you could say, was an antithesis of the minimalist model for art making, in the sense that it was about creating a form of art which suggested that it was internally coherent. So it had its own. It was abstract. In the sense that it removed itself from immediate physical engagement, and I think that was one of the kind of binary that I'm talking about was a sort of problem, a big issue in art in the early 1960s. I mean, if you think about works like Stella Stripe paintings or even Morris Lewis's Poor paintings, they're in a way conflicted by this these two ways of seeing art. That they want to be purely manifest in space as physical objects and perceptual phenomenological objects that you engage with, or do they want to be about pictoriality, which is always about something not being there,
fictitious, or
I mean, if you think about what is a picture, I mean, something that's a picture, even if it's an abstract painting, you think of it deals with illusionism. The most geometric abstract, I mean, a Mondrian or something, deals with illusionism. It suggests breaks the pure literalness of the object and suggests space and ability to look into something.
Is that inescapable in a sense for painting?
I think it is. I think it's innate to painting, and that's why those Truid objects are interesting, because they are both painting and, I mean, she also made paintings.
Right. So they're combining perhaps almost different. I don't like the word language because it's a visual thing, but they're two different ways of making, aren't they? In one thing, perhaps.
And two different ways of conceiving of how at least at that time, and I think that seemed to me when I was writing this piece as a way of looking forward to. Since then, it suggests a kind of possibilities for how. I mean, what I mean is that I think that the idea of the traditional idea of sculpture, the idea of something which is occupying space and is present to your in relation to your presence. As for various reasons, since then become to seem problematic for artists. I don't really know why.
You talk about. I may misquote you, but you do the when you stand in front of a sculpture, the viewer has an image, and you talk about image, and then later on you do talk about the effect. I think on. Perhaps on sculpture, but it may be just on making art of the removed position that or the remote access, I think is the phrase you use, which we now have. Just leave that there for the second. You do talk about Yves Alain Bois, and you mentioned him talking about Barnett Newman. But you also talk about his associating of the mutual presence of artwork and the viewer with the directness and immediacy of speaking. And then you say that Jack Derrida rejected the primacy granted to speech. Can you just fill out that relationship to, say, either Anne Truitt's work or... You know, this thing about when we're looking at sculpture as viewers, how does that fit in? Because that was really interesting, that leap, in a sense, not a leap, but, crossing over to a different approach, in a sense, like speaking and writing, but in relation to sculpture, I thought.
Well, I was thinking about this idea of presence, and which is, I mean, as I explain, try to explain, sculpture is traditionally a medium of presence, as distinct, or as to some extent distinct from painting, which is about projection. You know, so I mean, Derrida was someone who argued against presence. I think that the point with the Newman reference is that I suggest that, to me at least, the work of Truitt's, that the work that's most informative to Truitt is Barnett Newman's paintings.
We talk about the zip paintings, right?
These upright stripes which run down the middle of fields of color, and those, and then it's the question is, how do those zips actually work? Because they're not analogies for a figure. That would be, as Bois points out, that would be very reductive. But they somehow resist illusionism in the paintings in which they feature, I think.
Right. You mean you don't see space or windows? Or...
Yeah, but they bring the painting into the present tense.
Yeah.
Bois, the writer, the critic, he associates this coming into the present tense with speaking, with the shift from the past to a present tense, and from addressing the painting, addressing the viewer directly.
I to you.
Yeah, and that's how he puts it, and I think that. That Derrida makes the point that he's actually making a distinction between speech and writing, and he's saying that speech has always been granted primacy culturally because it's more immediate, because it allows because it came first in the sense of how these forms of communication develop. And he's saying this is the wrong way around, that actually writing is a much broader phenomena, because writing is something which can happen, which can still function in the absence of the speaker or the person the speaker is addressing. So I was just speculating on that distinction as a model for how a lot of the work that I'm talking about, as you say, is about resisting or undermining, subverting the presence of the physical object in space, and the claims to authority and to visibility that implies, entails, and with forms of remote with suggestions of what that the object suggests something else, suggests something beyond itself, effaces itself in various ways, and the rest I'm talking when I'm talking about these more recent work by more recent artists, I'm actually thinking about different ways in which that is achieved through different strategies. For example, through taking a sculpture, which is an object, a physical object, using formalism as truth to somehow give it this projective dimension. Or, for example, you can use functionality. Artists also give objects a functional to suggest that it's something beyond its immediate presence, because of course a functional object is something that suggests a role that it has in the world, that it's something beyond its merely presence as an object, presence as an art object. So
it's use value.
Yeah, there's that, and then I also talk about images, the use of the image, the use of the way that the physical engagement with a sculpture can be questioned or resisted or circumvented by casting the object as an image in some way, which is to go back to what. To what sculpture was, I mean, if you think about traditional statues, you know, like a
yes,
Canova or something like that, or a Rodin, you know, these are also images.
Yes.
They're also representational. So obviously the thing about the sculpture which that emerged in the 1960s is that they were really resisting that. They were trying to eradicate that. They were repudiating it completely. They wanted something which was just there, not suggesting something that wasn't there, which is what images do almost always.
Yes. I mean, in principle, they're doing that, aren't they? So are we saying that now artists are going back in their approach by this image use?
Well, I mean,
or is it not? It's not that simple. I mean, because presumably what they're doing now is more complicated and different to the previous, like the rotor. I mean, I'm making too simplistic, because you talk about someone whose work seemed quite complicated to me and interesting. Was it? I'm not sure I'm going to say her name right. Is it Liz Deschenes?
Deschenes. She's someone who works with photography, or always has worked with photography. But photography that's unusually with an unusual emphasis on its material, physical. I mean, usually photography is a medium which effaces its physical. I mean, you look at a photograph and you see the image. You don't necessarily see the vehicle of the
The objectness of the presentation.
The objectness, of course. Since the 70s or 80s, there's been a lot of photography which does the opposite to that.
Purpose, sort of consciously.
Where in order to cultivate a sense of the objectness of it, like Thomas Stroot or something like that, or Jeff Wall. But she's someone who does that, drawing on, I don't know, maybe minimal art, maybe always done that. So she creates these objects which are not 100% clear that they are photographs very often, but they're photograms. So they're things which are photographic paper that's been exposed to light to turn them into what are actually, by definition, images. Even though you can't see anything in them, you can just see very often they look a bit like patinaed metal or something. But they were often shaped, not just rectangular or square, in order to, maybe that's a minimalist inheritance, to suggest the objectness of them, to cultivate, to emphasize the objectness of it. Yeah, but her recent work is really, really taken a big leap, and she's suddenly making work which actually, in some of the recent pieces, they actually don't have any photographic component, which as far as I know, she's never done before. So they're just made out of glass or fabric, or there's no photograph. There's no, so the elements of the image, they're actually sculptures.
They sound like it, yeah.
And they also look like minimalist sculptures in the sense that they've got these geometric forms like a tube, like a cylinder, or a hanging sheet of material and in a geometric shape, and yet they somehow comprehend the image context of a photographic practice. And I think that's that they do something interesting with sculpture in that regard. They bring out, they elicit from it they use this idea of the image or the conception of the image as a property of sculpture to question what sculpture is, and they have a very unusual presence. They kind of negate themselves as much as they make themselves present, and that's what I'm writing about.
That's at the Martin Gropius Bau.
Yeah, it's
currently as we speak, isn't it? Yeah, I'm hoping to see it next week. I'm coming.
Oh, great! Yeah, do go and see it. It's also an interesting combination because I mean I didn't it's her work alongside the American sculptor Peter Hujar, who worked in the 70s.
60s, 70s. Okay, so completely different time.
Very different, but a very interesting combination, a very interesting association, because and nicely curated, quite sensitive in terms of the relation between these two very different artists, both working to some extent with photography, and also because it shows this new work of Deschenes, which for me was a revelation. I'd never seen. I would not have expected her to make work like this, given the fact that the work she's made previously has been fairly within a very narrow bandwidth, at least the work I've seen of hers.
You talk about Isa Genskin and also Tricia Donnelly, amongst others. They both use marble, I think, Ryan's saying. How is that? I mean, they obviously do it differently, but is there... Because obviously marble is a very traditional material in sculpture. So how are they doing it in a way that's not like that? Because I think they're not, are they?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that you can use something which is so obviously has connotations with certain forms of traditional sculpture, you can use it ironically, or you can use it, to use the associations it has. I mean, I think that the Donnelly's work is the marble is a I don't know whether it's ironic. I think they're very difficult objects to define, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. What's interesting about them is that they have this very very blatant, palpable material presence. So they're big, there's a lot of precise physical detail which reveals their production, how they've been cut, how they've been shaped. The fact that it's black marble or grey marble or pink marble, the way it glitters, all this stuff. So they're very much there. And yet it's very hard to actually define what they are. You can't. They don't seem to represent anything. They don't look like they're functional, although they evoke various forms of functional object, nor exactly do they seem 100% like formalist sculpture, in the sense that like what we'd call abstract art. So the fact that they refuse to be pinned down is one way, I think, of evading the kind of definition, which they might kind of ironically hint at by being made of something with such strong material, traditional sculptural connotations as marble. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'd hesitate also to call them ironic. I think, in a way, they're just extremely evasive and very difficult to they're difficult to define. And that's exactly what. So it's another way of trying to show how something which is so present can also make itself elusive.
Yes. Which is clever for a heavy lump and object. Isaac Genskin.
Mm.
She uses marble and steel. And obviously she proposes some things which never get made, I think, as well, like monuments. But how does she use? Different to?
Yeah, I think with her the irony is much more apparent. It's more obviously ironic.
Yeah,
that she's using her work is she's in a way taking the piss out of the monumentality of sculpture, even as she's making monumental objects. So she's having it both ways.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of these artists I'm writing about are doing, having it both ways. They're making objects, but they're also kind of saying, well, I don't really trust objectness. And I think that there's something a bit hubristic and absurd even about having big fat thing in space, especially in a time when everything is so movable and so when value is so slippery, and that's what gives it its we associate in these days content with the strength of content, often with its ability to be fleet of foot, to be able to transmit itself fast among different, to be not easily localized. And I think that, you know, I think Genskin is her sculpture is actually really engaging precisely with these issues, like how can you make something monumental in this anymore? Is it credible? Is it plausible?
Yeah.
And she does that partly by making a joke of that, the idea of monumentality. And she does that using, and I think the one of the most, I love her proposals for sculpture. So she's making, they're like brilliant jokes. So she does a proposal. Often, I mean, at least in Germany, you have these things called Kunst am Bau, which is like they're things that you apply for, and a local authority says we want to put a sculpture in the square somewhere, and they elicit proposals from various artists, and a lot, I think some of these proposals are actually come out of those kind of occasions. So she. She does there's a big building in a photograph of a building. She's actually just put a little picture of a photocopy of an aerial onto the top of it. So it looks like a transistor radio. I mean, this is never going to be built. She's actually making fun of the process that she's engaging with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also in principle, when these things have been built, which is, I mean, there was a Genskin retrospective at the Neue National Gallery here in, I think, 2 years ago, and then it was all the sculptures were in the building. Outside was this big sculpture of a rose she made, just called Rose. It's like
huge,
and it's just a reproduction of painted, colored reproduction of a rose. And whenever I see this, I think I've seen it before somewhere else. I've definitely seen reproductions of it. I always think it looks like something which has been made in order to make fun of the idea of making it, in order to actually subvert its own presence by inference. So you look at it and you think, nah, it should have stayed as a, it should have remained as a sketch, because it would have been, as a sketch, it would have been funny in the idea of, yeah, you don't want to make that, but she actually makes it.
Yeah.
And but a lot of these proposals just remain as proposals, which is also just as funny and just as,
yeah.
But he's actually riffing on, she's making fun of the idea of sculpture, sculptures,
pomposity.
Yeah. For example, I mean, just the whole idea that it just takes up space and it's
demanding,
and it stays in one place, a lot of these things seem quite absurd now, and also the fact that it's so easily commodifiable.
Yeah. Talking about lack of commodification, or perhaps a desire to evade that happening. You talk about two people. One particularly, is it Iulia Nestor?
Iulia Nestor.
Iulia Nestor, her Superfluous Fire Doors in Plan B Gallery.
Yeah.
Where basically, well, you better describe them really. But basically, she put in doors that were really meant to be not noticed by the people going round the gallery, but just to be felt as if they were like standard institutional kind of necessities. But in reality, they were not necessary, were they?
No, I mean the gallery had emergency exit doors in several places in the gallery, and she does this as. It's a series of work she does, which she calls interventions, where she places something in the space, in an institutional space, gallery space, which tends to evade notice, partly because it's developed or it imitates something that's already there, but does it in a way which is unnecessary or does it simply artificially. So for example, these doors, but what's the difference between a door that's an emergency door with a sign on top of it that's there, that is a real emergency door, and one that's been placed there by her? Only that it's been placed there by her. And also that very often the only way that you would actually identify the superfluity of these doors was by the fact that looking at them, you might think, why do we need two doors on this wall? It just, or the door doesn't lead anywhere. So they're very labor intensive to produce, and yet they're there to be missed.
But they're quite big, actually, quite big.
Well, there is
material objects, really, as well.
They're not illusions. They're not illusions of doors. They're real doors. She just had them put in order to. I mean, the thing to bear in mind is that this was an exhibition of her paintings and some other and other things and also some text works. So the in the gallery, in conjunction with these doors, were also objects which would be much more immediately and automatically recognizable as art objects. So that as soon as a viewer entered the gallery, they think, oh, there's the art, there are the paintings. And that would, you could say that I'm not going to try to speculate on her intentions but I think that one of the things that the doors do is to create a kind of alternative or a decoy from the conventional primary object of attention that an art the occasion of looking at art in a gallery involves. So you've got, you go in, it's a very set the way this usually happens, what you're expecting to happen is very fixed in many ways. And she's like disrupting it in a way. But it's very interesting that she's using sculpture, which is actually the medium which is usually most manifest physically and most visible and most there in a physical sense, to actually as this decoy element in the space, this thing which you probably won't see. I mean, a lot of people who were at the gallery, who would have visited the gallery, would have gone there. But these intervention works that she does are not mentioned anywhere to a visitor. They're not on the list of they're not in the press. They're not mentioned in a press release. They're not on the list of works. So that you could very easily, and I think probably many people did, go into the gallery and not realize that they are part of the exhibition. They're like it's like you're being, there's something trick, it's like a trick, like a sort of it's mischievous.
Yeah, definitely. So someone who wasn't mischievous, I don't think, but also made works, I think, to evade notice, was Beverly Buchanan, you talk about. Can you tell us what she did?
Yeah, again, this is an artist who made some works which it seems as if they were made not to be seen, which is a kind of, for an artist, it seems like a contradiction.
I mean, after all, Marsh Ruins.
The works that I'm writing about were, I think the job description, you could say that the job description of being an artist is to attract attention in the most very basic sense. And these are artists who are making work which is meant to evade attention. So, and yet out of the medium of sculpture, which is an interesting kind of paradox, I think. Yeah, I mean, these were works which she made in the 1970s. And they look like bits of, they look like the kind of junk things that are left over from from building and construction in the city or the landscape. So things that might be fragments, relics, bits of broken off bits of architecture, but in fact they look contingent. In other words, they look like something which is just evolved by chance. But in fact, they're cast objects. So cast out of, but they're almost, they look like they're almost nothing. They're like bits of blocks of lime and sand and cast in this indeterminate kind of a form, and placed originally, as I understand it, in the landscape around her environment, but in a way that they would be likely to be missed, there'd be no reason to assume that they were art objects. So they're like secrets, but secrets which also imply that something needs to be hidden, maybe. And why would that be? You know?
But to know that it needs to be hidden, it would need to be found. I mean, to know that it has been hidden.
Paradoxical.
Yeah. Which is a bit like the doors in the gallery, the fire.
Yes, it is. But the difference is that the Buchanan sculptures were designed to make themselves invisible in public space, whereas Nista's interventions, almost as far as I think there's one exception to this, but in every other sense, they're made to function in art space, so that they play on the assumptions you bring to visiting an art space. And if you were to put Nista's objects in public space, they wouldn't have the same, they wouldn't work in that way, Nista's interventions. Whereas these Buchanan things, the objects, the sculptures that Buchanan made, I saw them in an art institution. And in that context, they didn't work because they were framed as sculptures from the past, archival presentation of this artist's work. So they lost the charge that they would have originally had when they were placed in a place where they were actually meant to evade notice.
Yeah, which doesn't make doesn't make sense to have moved them in a way, but hopefully they did show them with some information about their original placement. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think even if they showed them with information, the information would still have it would still have only just put inverted commas around them, and they would still have not been able, have not had the effect that they would have had in their original. So they were they're context specific. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. You towards the end of your feature, you talk about a German phrase, which I'm probably looking to see what it was. I had it a second ago, and now I've gone and lost it. Here we are. The word Gegenstand.
Gegenstand, yeah.
Gegenstand. What? Why did you write about that?
Well, I was. I think it's an interesting. I mean, you know, language works in. It's a word which in German, I mean, literally, gegen is against, stand is stand, so it means stand against. But what it means is object. We use that word in German to mean object. But it also has a different meaning, which is subject, in the sense that you can talk about, you can use the words, for example, to say that this is a subject for discussion, and you'd use the word Gegenstand for subject.
Right.
So it struck me that, well, I mean, I like the idea of this word stand against, in the sense that I think that one of the things these artists are doing is creating work that works against the standingness of sculpture. The way that sculpture it corresponds to our own standingness. We stand in the space, the object, especially a lot of the works I've specifically focused on in this text are works which are literally, explicitly standing in the sense that they're vertical. They're vertical objects. Also, the doors by Julian Nista, they're also standing objects. They suggest that we can go through them, our standing bodies. We can enter them. So yeah, they're all. A lot of this work is about resisting, working against the standingness of sculpture and the immediacy of sculpture. And so that phrase seemed kind of apt, sure. And also the way that double meaning of subject and object seems to be also really crucial to the way that this kind of sculpture is working, in the sense that it seems to reflect the viewer, and at the same time it withholds itself from the viewer, using illusion, using irony, using formalistic abstraction, all of these different ways of resisting allowing the viewer to categorically associate, empathize, see themselves in the object.
Or to walk away saying, I got it.
Yeah, or even to walk away saying, I saw it. Yeah. In the sense of the NIST object or the Buchanan objects, you go there where they are. They're there. You miss them. You don't see anything. You don't realize you've seen them. But of course you have seen them. And I think that that's the point, that there's this difference which they imply between seeing actively and seeing passively. Is that it's not as if you'd have walked in that landscape and those objects had been there, you might have actually seen them. You just didn't know what you were seeing. So this is also work which, in terms of the subject-object dichotomy, they're emphasizing the fact that seeing art is very much is a lot about what we see. What seeing is about what we as seers bring to the work as much as what's there. This is a truism, but it's an issue that this work raises.
It acknowledges it as well
and makes an issue of it. Yeah, it says, well, what do we bring to this, and what do our expectations of what we bring to this engagement how do they define the engagement with the art object?
It sounds in a way, if you think of the development of art and thinking, you know, the human race generally, we're developing a greater, the complications of everything are getting greater, and so it just sounds really like an acknowledgement of that, the richness and complication of everything, which is growing. I mean, we haven't really talked about the internet, but that whole other way in which we see things, you know, that complicates things, and then acknowledge those things within work when people make them. It would be almost wrong not to try.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, also, when I talk about this remote, this self-effacing quality of these works, that also comprehends virtuality, the fact that so much of the stuff we perceive, artificially generated content that we perceive is not there, but makes itself appear to be there.
Yeah.
Nowadays. So, I mean, what could be more other than that, than the basic standard idea of sculpture, which is, after all, something which is very much there,
yeah,
physically, materially, and also, you know, corresponding to our own presence, our own physical.
Yeah, for me, the laser cut marble works we mentioned before.
They're laser cut, right.
They do, just the fact that they're laser cut.
Yeah.
And if you know that, or you can tell that's a whole new technology. It's a whole other, you know, it's not your hand carved.
Right. That's another aspect of those works, that they look a little bit like 3D printed objects.
Exactly.
Which comprehends the fact that it has a computer generated source, even though it's a three-dimensional object. They have something of that quality, just because of the way that they're cut. So that that also removes them from the human equation to some extent.
You mentioned Emmanuel Levinas's concept of alterity. I mean, that's going back on what you were saying a minute ago, really. But that's an interesting about people resisting being assimilated by our experience or mental representations of them. That was quite a complicated ending, but a good one, I thought. I also know we haven't talked about, just because it goes back to the very first work by Truitt, Eyes Against Skin's, what I think it is called, Untitled 1980. She did, they're vertical. We illustrated some vertical sculptures that seem to have images in the side of them.
Yeah. She made a lot of these sculptures in this form in the, I think, the late 90s, early 2000s, which are like, they're just columns. They're columns, sorry. In terms of form, they're very, very close to Truett's. In terms of the geometric physical form, they're almost like a lot of Truett's work from the 70s. Except that they're coated with these photographs, marble panels, and kind of design paraphernalia that she's bought from the places where designers buy stuff,
samples and things like that.
Yeah, so they're in a way that again, it's about eroding, undermining the straightforward physical presence that the objects in their form suggest.
Yeah.
It's even the way that they're broken up, that the surfaces are so, have all these, the variety of different things that she attaches to them, whether it's marble, stone bits, different images. Yeah, I mean, it's like she's puncturing the presence of the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
She did that a lot in those works at that time.
Mark, we're out of time. Thank you so much, and you're listeners. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great. Well, listeners, the idea of this program is that you will really want to read Mark's fuller and more complicated and more interesting than either of us have managed to do today, although I hope you have enjoyed the programme, of course, and Mark's been brilliant. But it's in the June issue of Art Monthly 2026, number 497. Thank you so much for listening to the Art Monthly talk show. This will be broadcast on Resonance Radio FM as well, and then it becomes a podcast, which may be where you're listening to it now, which is a bit weird to think that these podcasts can actually go on and last probably longer than I will live. I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and feel that horrible understanding. Thanks again, Mark, for coming on.
Thank you.
All the very best in Berlin.
Okay, speak soon, Mark.
Speak soon. Bye-bye. Having encouraged you to read Mark Prince's feature article from the June issue of Art Monthly 2026, just let you know that you can subscribe to Art Monthly, and we'd love you to do so by going to our website, www.artmonthly.co.uk. It's possible to subscribe to print only, print and digital, or digital only. Now, the digital gives you also the current issue, which you receive exactly on publication date, but also access to all the issues in our archive going back to 1976, and it will be 500 issues in October 2026, so you'd have a lot of magazines to search through and read, and you can search for a specific subject that you're interested in, or a person, an artist, a writer, whatever. So that's artmonthly.co.uk website by page for subscribing. Best way to read Mark's feature article and many other writers' articles as well, of course. Thanks again for listening to the Art Monthly talk show. Bye-bye.